Hi there, dolls, music lovers, and fashion enthusiasts. Welcome to Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s, the podcast that takes you on a groovy journey through the lives and legacies of the incredible women who shaped these iconic decades. We are your hosts, Emma
and Abby,
and together we'll explore the story behind the music, the fashion, and the cultural revolution that defined an era.
Each episode will shine a spotlight on a remarkable woman, from rock and roll rebels to fashion icons, and dive into their impact on the world. We'll uncover the historical context, chat with experts, and celebrate the lasting influence of these trailblazing ladies. So, grab your bell bottoms and get ready to rock and roll as we uncover the untold stories of dolls who left their mark. Let's dive in. I just remembered this, and I remembered texting you saying, we have to save this for the cold open.
Yes.
While I was on location filming with these cows at a dairy farm, my friend and I were like, okay, let's go get ice cream while we're here. So we walk the little ways up the hill to the ice cream place. We get a few pints. They're all wrong, by the way.
Oh, no.
This poor kid gave us all of the wrong flavors, and I felt so bad. And as we're walking back to the car, I kick my foot out. A chunk of half of the sole of my shoe just goes flying out across the road.
We've all been there.
So I go, there is no way. And I stand there and with my sole of my shoe in my hand, and I look at him and I go, do you know what this is? Because this is the same friend that I was with when I lost the soles of both of my boots in Manhattan. It's the sole of my shoe. So we had to go and find some duct tape to tape my shoe back together so we could, like, finish the day. I get that wrapped up. It's fine. We go to this record store that I've been at before. Hilarious interaction with the owner, by the way. There was this 20-minute interaction about this guy named Michael Lloyd. I guess there's a whole Michael Lloyd verse that I never knew about. It's just because I mentioned the exact wrong album, and this guy was like, do you know about Michael Lloyd? Starts going in the back and, like, taking out all of his personal albums, like, here, put this on the turntable, here, look at this jacket, Michael Lloyd, Michael Lloyd. The owner's wife comes into the store, and the owner looks at her and goes, Karen, two words, Michael Lloyd. And she just shakes her head.
She has been through this several times.
So I get the feeling she's been hearing this for the past 27 years. But as I'm standing there listening to the whole explanation of the Michael Lloyd verse, and this guy is also being really cool, like burning me a couple CDs of stuff and, like, showing me around things I might like in the store, I can feel it. And I look down, I pick up my other foot, and lo and behold, the sole of my other boot is just hanging pathetically off my shoe.
Well,
I have no duct tape with me in the middle of this store, so the whole ride home, I'm just chilling with my one and a half shoes.
Vintage shoes crumble so violently. It's not just the It's not just that the sole detaches. They fully crumble. Like, they disintegrate to nothing within a minute. You're like, what the heck just happened?
It's like my shoes were Thanos snapped out of existence while I was wearing them. And this will absolutely give away what tax bracket I am from. I took them right home, and the next morning, I E6000 glued that shit back together. Because I'll be damned if I lose these boots.
I'm the same. I always joke that my whole closet is held together by fabric glue and pins. And it really is the truth, because with some pieces, I have mended them so often that I don't even try anymore. I'm like, yes, I could mend this seam, but it's gonna come apart in like a week again anyway, because the material's already so flimsy, so I might as well just use a pin. It's gonna be fine.
I have a safety pin in my shirt right now, because I lost a button and I didn't remember.
It's the way to go.
That is such an end of the season mood, just holding things together with duct tape and safety pins and hoping for the best.
It really is. But this season has also been a lot longer than we planned because we were just kind of like, might as well do another episode. Oh, it's so fun. Let's do another one and another one.
Yeah. Yeah. The only reason we are wrapping this season when we are right now is because you have a baby on the way very soon.
Yes. Very, very soon.
We'll be back and we'll have a third tiny little co-host. Do we just go into this?
I'm excited. Because
people clicking on the title, they already know what's up.
Maybe we should just all take a collective deep breath.
Yeah, just to center ourselves.
Go into this with an open mind.
But you're also going to hear some stuff that makes you mad. It is an honor and a pleasure to present part one of our two-part season finale and the last installments of our Beetle Girl miniseries. She is the single most controversial woman in rock and roll history. Ladies and gentlemen, guys and dolls, Yoko Ono. Cue an army of listeners one-star rating these episodes just because they're about Yoko Ono. So, while researching this episode, I reached an immediate conundrum. There is no well-rounded source on Yoko Ono. While it is true that every author and every director has an angle, there is no such thing as a source without bias. Yoko just brings out extremes in people. Either they love Yoko and she's never done anything wrong ever, or they hate Yoko and she's the source of all the world's evil. I base this episode on David Sheff's book Yoko, but it's not infallible. He cites Philip Norman and Mark Lewison, two authors I refuse to use, and David became close friends with Yoko. David is the author of memoir Beautiful Boy, about being a father to an addicted son. The book was adapted into a movie starring Steve Carell and Timothée Chalamet, who played David's son Nick. The friends who helped Nick recover in Beautiful Boy were Yoko and Sean. They let him stay at their farm in upstate New York and paid for his treatment. Nick is now living a sober life with his wife, so clearly David is very emotionally invested in telling Yoko's story. While he provides valuable insight to her inner workings, he cannot be objective about her. So I cross-reference this book to hell and back. I used Sheff's The Playboy Interviews with John and Yoko and the earlier, much angrier, Lennon Remembers by Jan Wenner. I've also cited the Beatles anthology and the one-to-one John and Yoko documentary. Sheff's choice gaps in his narrative are filled with May Pang's memoir Loving John and Cynthia Lennon's memoir John. Even after all that, Yoko's art is hardly covered in depth. That's what most of part one is going to be about. For this area, I used Woman, The Incredible Life of Yoko Ono, but specifically Barb Younger's chapter. I am convinced the editor was on vacation for the whole rest of the book. And Jay Oberman's fantastic Everything Is Now. Thank you to friend of the show Brian Wendorf for tipping me off to that book. Emma also sent me her bibliography from her own Why Yoko Did Not Break Up the Beatles video. Thank you, Emma, for sending that Interview magazine profile and New York Times article my way. All of these are listed in the show notes if you'd like to check any of them out for yourself. Oh, so that was our big fat disclaimer.
But now let's go back to the early and humble beginnings of Yoko Ono.
Humble beginnings. That's funny.
Yoko Ono was born February 18th, 1933, in Tokyo, Japan, to Isoko Yasuda and Isuke Ono. While many marriages in this era of Japanese history were arranged, Isoko and Isuke fell in love. They defied their families to be together. The Yasudas were Buddhists, the Onos were Christian. Isoko was a daughter of the Yasuda dynasty, one of the wealthiest and most influential families in pre-war Japan. The Yasuda bank fortune made Sanjiro Yasuda unbelievably wealthy. He was essentially the J.P. Morgan of Japan, and his wealth was able to give Isoko and Isuke a royal wedding. Yoko wanted for naught in her early childhood. Her and her brother Kei had house staff to wait on their every beck and call. They had summer and winter homes to vacation at, and Yoko was sent to school specifically for the arts. Though the Ono children had everything they could have ever wanted, they didn't have their parents' affection. My parents were close to each other, but not with me, Yoko said. If she wanted to see her businessman father, she had to make an appointment to visit his office. Meanwhile, her heiress mother, Isoko, was caught up in her own affairs. Quote, I adored my mother, but it wasn't reciprocated. She was too busy with her own life. Yoko was mostly raised by nannies, to be seen and not heard. Isoko's distant nature was both freeing and confusing for Yoko. While Yoko didn't feel in debt to her mother or feel too attached to live her own life, she craved some kind of affection. Isoko's love of the arts rubbed off on Yoko. Being a high society girl, she painted, played multiple instruments, and was trained in traditional Japanese singing. Aisuke was a piano prodigy. Being raised in both Japan and America made Yoko feel alienated from both cultures. She was too westernized for Japan and far too Japanese for the white children to play with her. She excelled in school but suffered from anxiety and depression. Quote, I learned to show my parents what they wanted to see. I wanted them to be proud of me, to like me. In home movies, she danced and played with her brother. But I was very unhappy, Yoko remembered. There was a tremendous amount of weight on her to succeed, to be worthy of her parents' love. She also struggled to socialize with other kids, having been so sheltered by her parents. They drilled it into Yoko's head to be suspicious of other people. In 1937, the Ono family's lives were forever changed, as Japan escalated their war on China, not formally declared until 1941, Aisuke sent his family back to Tokyo from where they were in San Francisco. When Japan officially aligned itself with Germany and Italy, officially creating the Axis powers, Isoko brought the children back to America, fearing soon they would stop allowing Japanese citizens into the country. Anti-Japanese sentiments were growing. As Yoko's parents walked her to school, people yelled slurs at them. When they went to films, white actors in yellowface portrayed the villains. In 1941, when Yoko had just turned 8, the Onos left America. The next year, the first wave of Japanese Americans were sent to internment camps. Soon after coming back to Tokyo, Aisuke was sent to Vietnam to work for his bank's branch in Hanoi. That December, Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, officially drawing the United States into World War II. Nightly air raids became commonplace. On March 9th of 1945, the United States dropped 1,665 tons of bombs on Tokyo. At least 100,000 civilians were killed, and the city was leveled. While Isoko, Kei, and Yoko's baby sister, Setsuko, hid in the bomb shelter below the garden, Yoko was left inside in an upstairs bedroom. Through her high fever, Yoko could hear the bombs whistling through the air. She could feel the house shake when they detonated. She watched Tokyo burn from the window. After the bombing, Yoko and her family fled to a rural farming village. The family was entirely ill-prepared for such a drastic change in circumstances. Isoko wasn't equipped for the lifestyle. Yoko remembers her fine silk clothing being covered in mud as she wheeled a wheelbarrow. It was all she brought to wear. After buying the house, the rest of their money was worthless. Isoko had to peddle away priceless family heirlooms, but even then, they could hardly afford to eat. It was here that Yoko's retreat into her imagination began. Lying on their backs under a hole in their roof, Yoko cheered Kai up by inviting him to play pretend. They'd make a menu of all the food they couldn't wait to eat once the war was over. Their imaginations helped them endure. Kai considers Yoko's imaginary menu her first conceptual art piece. Yoko was often sick as a child, either from anemia, starvation, or other ailments. She had to have her appendix removed, but due to a shortage during the war, she endured the surgery without any painkillers or anesthetics. She was abused by one doctor, and described in a later artwork a doctor kissing her on the mouth. In all this time, the Onos had lost contact with Aisuke.
The Ono family didn't know Japan surrendered on August 15th, 1945. They had no radio. Yoko only heard the news at school that day. After a few more months, Isoko decided it was safe enough to bring her children back to Tokyo. When they arrived, there was nothing left of the city. People were living in shacks where their homes once were, leveled by American bombing. The Yasuda fortune was gone, the bank dismantled. In 1946, Aisuke finally returned home.
He had been interned in a camp in Vietnam. Through the rest of Yoko's teenage years, the Ono family tried their best to rebuild. Eisuke was convinced Yoko would be a piano prodigy like he was. But at the last minute, she skipped her final music exam, instead begging her parents to send her to study philosophy. They agreed, mostly because stubborn Yoko would not have accepted any other answer but yes. In the fall of 1952, she became the first ever female philosophy student at the prestigious Gakushin University in Tokyo. Meanwhile, Yoko's parents gave her mixed signals about marriage. Isoko was a modern woman. She told Yoko she could do anything she wanted in life. At the same time, Isoko was a society woman, obsessing over Yoko marrying into a suitable family. Caught between two worlds, she simultaneously praised her daughter's independence and shamed it. Yoko, too, was caught between two worlds. When Eisuke was moved back to the New York branch of the Bank of Tokyo, Yoko dropped out of school after a year to follow her family there. Her parents were exasperated, but nonetheless funded her attendance of the famous Sarah Lawrence College in Bronxville. She changed her major from philosophy to art. Yoko was inching closer and closer to the city she loved most in the world, New York. But she was too Japanese for the mostly white student body. She had a boyfriend, Mel Woody, the inspiration for Cal in The Bell Jar, but it didn't last. Describing the dance Yoko met Mel at, Sylvia Plath's biographer Heather Clark said, quote, "Yoko was clearly the most beautiful girl, but she was Japanese, so no one was dancing with her." When Mel discovered Yoko had attempted suicide as a teenager, he dropped her. At Sarah Lawrence, Yoko's domineering nature came out. She wasn't exactly friendly. College friend of hers, Betty Rollins, said, quote, "She would roll over anyone she perceived as standing in the way of her artistic vision. If you didn't interest her, you didn't exist." This aloof attitude might be hailed as cool in a male artist, but with Yoko, it was seen as rude. And she was very ambitious, obsessed with creating. She could study whatever she pleased at Sarah Lawrence. She was never one to be limited by artistic medium. She could draw, paint, sculpt, sing, or write poetry. The October 26, 1955 issue of the school newspaper published her short story, On a Grapefruit in the World of Park. It was the first of many appearances of grapefruits in her work. At this time, though, she really wanted to be a composer. She began skipping class and parties. When she wasn't holed up in the library, immersing herself in the works of guys like Arnold Schoenberg and Igor Stravinsky, she escaped to Greenwich Village. 1956 was Yoko's junior year of college, and the Beat Movement was at its very height. Allen Ginsberg wrote his signature poem Howl that year. Jack Kerouac would release his movement-defining On the Road the next. Kids dressed in all black, the Café Wa had yet to be opened, but the Miles Davis Quintet played the Café Bohemia. Kind of Blue wouldn't be out for another 3 years. Sometimes Yoko brought her college friend Erica to beat poetry readings, jazz clubs, or art exhibitions in the city. Mostly she went by herself. Yoko's isolated, unstable childhood gave her the freedom to explore New York on her own. Making connections wasn't difficult. She got a job waitressing at the Paradox, a spot popular with fellow beatniks. At one of these shows, Yoko met her future first husband, Juilliard student Toshi Ichiyanagi. The relationship and her parents' disapproval of Toshi bore remarkable similarities to Isoko and Eisuke's beginnings. Toshi was even a piano player. New York was free, college was no longer. At the end of her junior year, Yoko dropped out of Sarah Lawrence. Toshi introduced Yoko to even more avant-garde music. He liked Schoenberg and early pioneers of electronic music, but his favorite was John Cage. His most famous piece, and my favorite, is 4:33. Just 4 minutes and 33 seconds of silence. The music was different every time because complete silence is never possible. A car drives past the concert hall, someone shuffles in their seat or sneezes. The door opens and shuts. It's totally free, and it can never be played the same way twice. Toshi and Yoko shared their love for Dada artists, like Marcel Duchamp.
Dada was all about absurdity. We see that over and over in Yoko's antics. Duchamp was the art world's very first troll, causing uproar when he unveiled an upside-down urinal as an art piece. Dada was seriously unserious, and Yoko was all about that. It was the very antithesis of what was being shown at institutions like the MoMA, which will be relevant later. Yoko was making art nonstop, but she couldn't figure out where or how to show it.
Even with New York's bursting avant-garde art scene, it was difficult to explain Yoko's instructional pieces. Before avant-garde art, there was a strict artist-art-viewer relationship. Artist makes art. Art is a static thing. Viewers observe art from afar. Instructional pieces broke this barrier down. The viewer was supposed to make the art that the artist created. Yoko's cough piece instructed the reader to, quote, keep coughing for a year. Love piece had them laughing for a week. The instructional pieces could also bring together a group. Wall piece for orchestra displayed her tongue-in-cheek humor. A full orchestra was to hit a wall with their heads. I think it is great that she was so unafraid to try this whole new thing.
She was always on the... Well, it's the very meaning of the word avant-garde. It's front of the guard. It is the front line. She is always willing to try the dangerous new thing.
Yeah, and I wonder whether it was stemming from her feeling that people didn't like her anyway. So she was like, I might as well just do the weirdest shit. Why not?
I might as well give them a reason not to like me.
Yes. And I love that. In late 1960, Yoko found a venue. She co-produced her first art shows, a group series in a loft at 112 Chambers Street. Her, Toshi, Richard Maxfield, Merce Cunningham, and Yoko's co-producer, Lamont Young, all occupied the space, playing historic loft concerts there. Yoko herself never headlined one of these concerts, but she performed work at Toshi's. One of these works was Pee-Pee's, in which she threw peas at the audience while whipping her long hair in a circle. The sound of her hair was the music. The peas invoked the ancient Japanese tradition of beans warding off bad spirits. To think, while Leave It to Beaver was on TV and the nuclear family was praised as the American dream, Yoko Ono was throwing peas at people in a loft. There is something truly poetic about all of that. Though the vast majority of students enrolled in art and art history programs at American colleges are women, men are greatly favored by the art world. For centuries, women in art were most valued as muses or models for works. The Guerrilla Girls commented on this in 1989 with their groundbreaking Do Women Have to Be Naked to Get into the Met Museum? Critiquing the number of nude female bodies on display at the Metropolitan Museum of Art versus women artists whose work is in their collections. Yoko experienced art world sexism firsthand. Lamont Young took more and more credit for her work, even introducing her to a journalist as the chick who owns his loft. John Cage, though, recognized her importance. They remained close friends, even after the loft concerts fell through. They connected over their interests in Dada and Zen Buddhism. On July 16th of 1961, Yoko put on her first solo exhibition with the help of Lithuanian artist George Masionis. Yoko displayed mostly calligraphy works and instructional paintings. Water drop painting was a bottle of water hung upside down in the gallery, dripping slowly on a canvas below until the bottle was empty. Yoko's exhibition lasted 2 weeks. Though attendance was poor, the gallery's lights were shut off after no one paid the bill. The whole gallery was shut down after Yoko's show, actually. George couldn't make the rent. It was very important to Yoko's career. Having even one solo exhibition under your belt is an incredible achievement. Word spread. Around this time, a new movement was born from the New York avant-garde. One that wasn't bound by style, medium, or even location. George Masionis wrote a manifesto for what would come to be known as Fluxus. Fluxus was about the ephemeral. These works weren't meant to last. This was exactly in line with Yoko's art. Though you could see a photograph of a bottle hung upside down in a gallery, or maybe a film of Yoko flinging peas, it's a moment in time that has passed. All that remains of the art is the experience you take away from having seen it in person, or in the instructional pieces case, having made it yourself.
That's where all the happenings came from, because Fluxus was really the birth of performance art.
I know a lot of people don't love performance art for several reasons, and...
because it gets so pretentious.
It does, and I understand that. And I also understand that people say there's a lot more craftsmanship in, like, painting a huge painting than to just stand on a stage and throw peas at someone. And I get that, but I do think that this early form of performance art was really great and something the art world needed as, like... a world that has always been evolving, but also always kind of been the same. It really broke off during this time.
Yeah. Think of how challenging performance art was at this time.
Yes.
Because you have, at about the same time, Andy Warhol is making this very flat work. He's screen printing stuff, and he's making Campbell's soup cans.
Yeah, which was also quite revolutionary, because he had this whole admiration for these mundane things. But I feel like, I don't want to insult anyone, but I do almost feel like performance art, it's sort of over. Everything that you can do now with performance art has already been done so many times before. So it does kind of get old, and it's not like... you might say someone has their own style of doing it, just like a painting is always a painting, but the style evolves. But I would argue that there's a difference.
Yoko performed her first solo concert at Carnegie Hall in November of 1961. She recited A Grapefruit in the World of Park and invited audience members to participate. A New York Times review of that concert described some of the happenings. Quote, "Against a taped background of mumbled words and wild laughter, a girl spoke earnestly about peeling a grapefruit, squeezing lemons, and counting the hairs on a dead child. Musicians in the corner made their instruments go squeep and squawk. Two dancers stood up and sat down alternately for some 10 minutes in silence. Then they sat down to a laden table and ended by breaking all the dishes." This was also the first time Yoko used her distinct vocalizations in a show. "I can hear you now, dear listeners. Oh god, the screaming!" Yoko described it as part a nod to kabuki, Japanese opera singing, part an emotional outlet. All the feelings she couldn't express to her mother and father, she expressed through her wailing. Her 1961 Scream piece instructs to scream, 1, against the wind, 2, against the wall, 3, against the sky. Thurston Moore of Sonic Youth later said, quote, "Yoko has a very innate sense of music and music theory. It's not like she's just shouting and blathering. It's so outside the sensibility of art criticism. They can't see the music as being important to the visual art, as the performance work. Her musical output has always been discounted in relationship to her art, but they are utterly intertwined." I do absolutely agree with the last point. Maybe stuff in the middle I'm not too sure about. But I guess it's meant to be abrasive and uncomfortable to hear.
I think that's the whole point. I do think, I mean, there are clips of Yoko singing somewhat normal.
Yeah, like whole albums. Whole albums.
Yes. She might not have the most beautiful voice. But I feel like for Yoko, it was always about doing something that wasn't conventional. It would have been almost too easy for her to just stand on a stage and sing a song.
And people might not have listened to the little short girl singing as much as they would listen to the little short girl screaming. Anyone can sing. Not everyone can scream. And I'll give her that.
And I also think she was really smart in a sense that she understood very, very early on that you have to be controversial for this to work out.
Mm-hmm.
And she was always controversial.
Any publicity is good publicity.
Yes, she really lived by that. And I have to say, I admire her for that because it takes an enormous amount of bravery to do that. And I do think a lot of people would never, ever have the guts to do that because it is... in a conventional sense, almost embarrassing.
Yes, yes. Like, try the Yoko scream right now. Try it for yourself right now.
Go ahead.
You will be embarrassed when you fail at it.
Put on a little show for your family and try pulling that off. throw peas at people and tell me you just feel fine about
it. Yeah! In 1962, when Yoko was 30, Tadanori Yoku, Japan's Andy Warhol, brought Yoko's show to Japan. She was shocked by the negative reception her art got in Tokyo. John Cage brought her on tour through Japan that same year to sing his aria and help perform his piano walk. She laid her long hair across the strings of an open grand piano, while Cage and other performers hit the strings with objects. Critics zeroed in on her presence, reducing her to little more than the assistant in the box to John Cage's magician, or Toshi's weird little wife. Yoko fell into a deep depression after the tour concluded. She attempted suicide multiple times, once making it into her open window to jump before Toshi snatched her out of it. After overdosing on pills, she was institutionalized. There, she met her second husband, American artist Tony Cox. Tony had traveled to Japan that same year to study calligraphy and Zen Buddhism. He was set, though, on meeting Yoko. She refused his visits to the mental hospital, but eventually she relented. Confused about where she was going in her life and still very anxious and depressed, she began an affair with Tony. This relationship moved very fast. In November of 1962, Yoko discovered she was pregnant. She wasn't ready to be a mother, but Tony pressured her to move forward with the pregnancy. Yoko divorced Toshi, married Tony in June of 1963, and on August 3rd, Yoko's first child, Kyoko Cox, was born. Though she struggled to muster up the maternal instinct new mothers have, being a mother did change her. Quote, "The first time I decided I never wanted to commit suicide again was right after I had Kyoko. Her birth freed me from that desire." Yoko's affair, divorce, and child brought disgrace on the Ono family. They all but disowned her, leaving Tony her only ally. He encouraged her to collect her instructional pieces into a book. In June of 1964, the first edition of Grapefruit was published. Grapefruit's instructional pieces were the epitome of conceptual art, all you need to replicate pieces like Earth Piece, where you listen to the sound of the earth turning, is your mind. You don't need formal training, a studio, a canvas and paints, or even a pen. Anyone can be an artist, Yoko thought. All it takes is imagination. A running theme in Yoko's art is absence. There's a lot of negative space, the color white, which is the absence of color, and black, a void of all colors. The same year as Grapefruit's publication, Yoko debuted one of her most famous works at Japan's Yamaichi Hall. Yoko would sit cross-legged and silent on stage, with a pair of scissors laid before her. One by one, participants were invited to cut away a piece of Yoko's clothing until there was nothing left. Yoko was very nervous the first time she performed it. This was a very vulnerable position to put herself in. At the show, one of the participants grabbed the scissors and mimed stabbing Yoko. Word of this piece made it back to Yoko's parents, who were ashamed their daughter would allow herself to be stripped naked on stage. For years, they shunned her. Yoko, Tony, and Kyoko moved to New York that fall. On March 31st, 1965, Yoko performed Cut Piece again at Carnegie Hall. Dressed in all black, she sat cross-legged on center stage, with the procedural pair of scissors before her. One by one, audience members were invited up to the stage to cut a piece of Yoko's clothing. The first few participants were respectful, cutting small pieces from the hem of her skirt, and the neckline of her sweater, and her sleeve. Then they returned to their seats. The tone changed when several young men cut away large parts of her skirt. They laughed as they got back in line. When one man cut away Yoko's slip, the audience protested. "For God's sake," a woman cried. "Stop being a creep!" Yoko was terrified. She cued the stagehand by nodding her head. As the same man cut her bra straps, exposing her breasts, the curtain closed. The next time Yoko performed Cut Piece in New York, men rushed the stage and ended the piece within minutes, leaving Yoko naked. The meaning of Cut Piece has fluctuated over the years. Sometimes it's a reference to the Prince Buddha achieving enlightenment by giving all his earthly possessions away, devoting himself to spirituality. Other times it's about trust. Most accept it as a feminist statement, a commentary on living in a body others feel entitled to.
Cut Piece inspired another iconic feminist performance art piece, Marina Abramovich's Rhythm Zero from 1974. Instead of one pair of scissors for audience members to cut away clothing with, Marina laid out a whole table of objects, from a feather boa to a pair of shoes, to a set of knives, and even a gun. Participants were invited to do whatever they wished to Marina with those objects. Some dressed her in the clothes on the table, others wrote on her with marker, and cut her face with the knives. Like, I knew that Yoko was an artist. That's just sort of in the public consciousness. But I remember in my modern art course, or contemporary art course, I think it was, I remember when we got to the Fluxus movement and Yoko's name popped up and I went, oh wow, I knew she was an artist. I didn't think she was that kind of artist. Be in my textbook, in my lecture. I didn't know she was that kind of artist. That completely reframed Yoko for me.
Yes. Cut Piece is such a revelation. I would argue one of the most famous performance art pieces there ever have been. And what I find incredibly fascinating is that a lot of people don't even know it was Yoko who did it. It's almost, we're gonna come back to this, that people only know Yoko for her connection to the Beatles, and a lot of people don't know who she was outside of it, which is why we wanted to focus, especially in this first part of the episode, on her as an artist. This whole Cut Piece thing is almost symbolic for me for what happened to her later on. The public scrutiny kind of tore her completely apart. People always thought that they were entitled to have some sort of opinion about her, to say what they want about her, and to honestly not treat her with a lot of respect. And she was also often a victim of racism, sexism, and all of these things. And I think that in a grim way, this was very foreshadowing of the life she would live in the public eye.
People felt entitled to Yoko Ono while also wishing to discard her.
People tend to forget that she had a whole life and a whole career before ever even meeting John Lennon, and that she was part of the public world and was known to the public even before she ever met John.
Yeah, maybe not a household name, but in the art world, she was quite famous.
Yeah. George Misiunas was very happy to have Yoko back in New York. He quickly incorporated her into his happenings and made copies of her Ono sales list, offering a sound tape of The Snow Falling at Dawn for 25 cents and poems for tens of thousands of dollars. It's included in later editions of her Grapefruit book. He invited Yoko to his festivals in Europe, where she eventually settled in London with Tony. At these festivals, Yoko began showing short films she shot with Tony. Behind the scenes, the relationship strained. As you can probably imagine, Yoko was an intense partner. She was very demanding of Tony, treating him as her assistant. On Yoko's side, she felt he was pressuring her into making art with him. Quote, "He wanted it to be the both of us. All I ever wanted was someone who would be interested in my work. I needed a producer." More accurately, she wanted a patron. She knew she could be part of a duo, but it had to be with the right guy. In 1966, the Beatles were the princes of pop music, Paperback Writer and We Can Work It Out, backed with Day Tripper, topped the charts, and Rubber Soul was another massive success. But there was trouble on the water. In July of 1966, the Beatles played a disastrous gig in the Philippines that ended with them just barely getting out of the country in one piece. On August 29th, 1966, the Beatles wrapped their last ever tour. That same month, John Lennon's little Bigger Than Jesus thing had fans in the American South burning Beatles records. The KKK picketed Beatles shows. It simply wasn't safe to continue on this path. While Yoko was the only woman artist at many Fluxus symposiums, John and the Beatles were finishing up work on their Revolver LP. David Sheff identifies Yoko was screaming on stage, having people get into her black bags, and debuted her number 4 Bottoms film, consisting solely of naked people's butts. Quote, "What initially inspired me to make such a film was our maid, whom I saw polishing the floor. The movement of her bottom was indescribably humorous," Yoko said about the film. She wanted it to be one of the most important films of the 1960s. People would remember Ingmar Bergman, Jean-Luc Godard, Michelangelo Antonioni, and Yoko Ono and her butts. It is so funny, though.
The audacity.
I like it. She was so confident.
Like, yeah, I'm on par with Jean-Luc Godard, and I'm making films with just butts.
Overconfident, in a sense. But I do also think that this is a phenomenon that we always see, that if men say something like that, it is much more accepted than when a woman says it.
Like when Andy Warhol made an hours-long film of, I think, just the Empire State Building, people just accepted it.
Yeah.
You know, a little kooky and maybe frivolous, and they're calling Yoko, oh, she's crazy. First usage of that word, people were calling her crazy.
They really were. Quote, "I hope they would see that the 60s was not only the age of achievements, but of laughter. Working class hero musician John and disowned heiress artist Yoko could not have come from more different worlds." One afternoon, Yoko's gallerist friend John Dunbar, Marian Faithfull's husband, if you'll remember, brought Yoko to visit his IndyCar gallery. Dunbar showed her the copies of Grapefruit for Sale and convinced Yoko to stage a show there. That show, in September of 1966, would change her and the Beatles' whole life paths. The night before opening, Dunbar brought John Lennon in to see Yoko's exhibition. John had heard of the people in the back and was intent on seeing people in the back. Where's the people in the back, you know? He thought people had sex in the back and wanted to try it.
Where's the people in the bag, you know? I want to see the bag.
What is going on here? When asked to explain back piece, Yoko said, quote, "All of us are in a bag, you know. The point was the outline of the bag, the movement of the bag, how much we see of a person. Inside, there might be a lot going on." At risk of sounding too serious, Yoko slipped her humor in at the very end. Or maybe nothing's going on. The bag piece wasn't at the Indica Gallery the night before Yoko's exhibition. Quote, "The place wasn't really open," John remembered, "but John Dunbar was all nervous, like the millionaire's come to buy something. He's flittering around like crazy. Now I'm looking at this stuff. There's a couple of nails on a plastic box. Then I look over and see a fresh apple on a stand with a note saying, Apple. I thought, you know, this is a joke. This is pretty funny. I was beginning to see the humor in it." The Revolver days had gotten all the Beatles into alternative avant-garde art. John, too, had an absurdist sense of humor. He jokingly asked Dunbar how much the apple was, to which he replied, £200. When John asked about the bent nails, Dunbar brought Yoko over to meet John. She handed him a card that said, "Breathe." John said, "You mean," and did some exaggerated breathing. "That's it. You've got it," Yoko replied. "I've got it," John thought. Then he turned around, grabbed the apple off the stand, and, in typical John fashion, did the first thing he thought of. He took a big bite out of the apple. Yoko was very upset. Who was this pop star to come in and desecrate her artwork, meant for sale the next morning? Apple was meant to be about the cycle of life. The viewer was meant to watch the undisturbed apple slowly rot over time. But she was impressed by John's sheer audacity. Again, in typical John fashion, he was distracted by another artwork. He went up on a ladder in the gallery and held a magnifying glass to his eye. There, painted very small on the ceiling, was just the word yes. That little yes deeply moved John. Quote, all the so-called avant-garde art at the time and everything was supposedly all negative. This smashed a piano with a hammer, break the sculpture warring negative crap. It was all anti-art, anti-establishment. And just that yes made me stay in a gallery full of apples and nails instead of just walking out and saying, I'm not going to buy any of this crap. All his life he'd heard, no, no, no. And here was a little yes. He asked about putting a nail in a board, meaning to be blank for the exhibition. Yoko said, okay, you can hammer a nail in for 5 shillings. John fired back. Well, I'll give you an imaginary 5 shillings and hammer an imaginary nail in it. Yoko realized John really had gotten it. The Indica exhibition opened as planned, with the apple John ate replaced. So was the beginning of John and Yoko.
I love that story.
It's a great story.
The imaginary hammer and the imaginary nail.
Yeah.
They were absolutely vibing.
Yes, and I think that Yoko was so used to being the wildest person in the room, mm-hmm. that she was somewhat even caught off guard by John, who I'm assuming she thought was this like pop star guy who didn't have a sense for art or a good sense of humor.
Yeah, he didn't understand what fine art was.
And he completely was on her level.
Completely usurped her expectations.
Yeah. Some, including John's bandmate Paul McCartney and John's wife at the time, Cynthia Lennon, accused Yoko of seeking out John as her patron, someone to fund her art and exhibitions. In Anthology, Paul remembered, quote, there was this girl called Yoko, Yoko Ono. She showed up at my house one day. It was John Cage's birthday, and she said she wanted to get a hold of some manuscripts of various composers to give to him. She wanted one from me and John, so I said, well, it's okay by me, but you'll have to go and see John. And she did. Accounts say she lobbied for artistic patronage from all the rest of the Beatles before finally landing on John. John Dunbar said this was, quote, absolutely not true. Who knows what was going on in their heads, but Yoko was preoccupied with the exhibit. He was just some guy who I had made a big deal about. She didn't stalk or pursue him. She was too cool for that. In Cynthia's memoir, she remembers Yoko sending mail to their house through the last of 1966 and into 1967. This included a copy of Grapefruit, which Cynthia remembers seeing on John's bedside table. This was a period when the Lennons' marriage was especially distant. John got more and more into psychedelic drugs, while Cynthia was not. John wrote Yoko off as just some crazy artist to his wife. Meanwhile, Yoko's relationship with Tony rapidly deteriorated. One morning, she awoke to find Tony had been gone all night. Quote, I realized that there was a half-empty space in my life, referring to the image of half the bed empty and still made. Half a room later became an installation at her Lisson Gallery exhibition in October of 1967. Everything in this faux apartment, the bed, tables, chairs, a bookshelf, even a vase with flowers, was painted white and cut in half. John attended the opening. Yoko tried to convince herself she wasn't interested in John, that she was too busy with her own work and she was still with Tony. But as we clearly know today, that didn't really work.
Come February of 1968, Yoko was preparing for a series of concerts with iconic jazz trumpeter Ornette Coleman. She still found the time, though, to write to John, who was at the Maharishi's ashram in Rishikesh with his wife. Every morning, John would rush out to the post office to collect his mail from Yoko. I'm a cloud. Watch for me in the sky, one said. While there, John wrote a song about his late mother, Julia, but it references Yoko's correspondence.
Her hair of floating sky is shimmering, glimmering in the sun. sing the song of love, Julia.
Ocean Child calls me. Yoko in Japanese means Ocean Child. John only grew more distant from Cynthia. When he returned from India, he invited Yoko to his home. Cynthia was on vacation with Magic Alex and their friends in Greece. John played Yoko some avant-garde recordings he'd made in his spare time. She suggested they make their own tape together. Quote, "She was doing her funny voices, and I was pushing all different buttons on my tape recorder and getting sound effects," John recounted. "And then, as the sun rose, we made love." This became their first album together, Two Virgins. The album cover of A Nude John and Yoko was so controversial, it was put in a paper bag for retail in the States. Oddly perfect for Yoko's bag piece.
It really is.
People were so up in arms about it. Future Carrie actress Sissy Spacek made a response song to it called John, You Went Too Far This Time. The same morning those recordings were made, Cynthia got home early from her vacation. She found John and Yoko sitting together, wearing the robes from their pool house. All John had to say was, "Oh, hi." Cynthia left in tears. 5 days later, John and Yoko debuted as an item at the opening of Apple Tailoring on King's Road. It was official. John's marriage was over. Naturally, the media erupted. Here was the most famous man in the world, flaunting his affair with this Japanese artist lady no one had ever heard of. Yoko was branded the homewrecker. Quote, "They never thought about the other side of it, that John might have broken up my home too."
I mean, we've spoken about this in the Cynthia episode.
Just get a divorce,
first of all,
buddy.
Yes.
Just get a divorce.
That. And secondly, how is no one seeing that the person who's, I don't want to say, but like the person who was responsible for this was John. Like he betrayed
his
wife.
He stepped out on
Yoko
his wife.
Didn't.
She also stepped out on her husband.
Yes, but it is often portrayed in a sense that Yoko kind of like, everything is put on her. People are like, well, John, yeah, he was there. No. He was like the main person in this.
He was an active participant.
The whole idea that this is always portrayed in a sense that Yoko came in and ruined a perfectly happy marriage is just not true. And even if John would be mainly responsible because he was the one cheating on his wife.
John, 1968 for John was a bad, bad year and he brought it all upon himself.
Oh my God. And it is wild how people almost infantilize him. Mm-hmm. And act as if Yoko ruined this perfect man. It's almost like John is this perfect guy who couldn't have done anything wrong, and then Yoko stepped in and ruined everything. And that just wasn't the case.
It does John a disservice, because number one, you can't tell John Lennon shit. He's gonna do what he wants to do no matter what anybody asks of him. Sometimes that goes very bad, and number two, it makes John seem like an unwitting participant, like a child.
Yeah.
He was most certainly was not a child. He was a grown adult man with free will.
Yes, and people always portray it as if the Beatles were broken up by Yoko because she was this huge force. And people...
We'll get into that.
Yes, and people just don't see that the Beatles were four grown adult men
very wealthy, very successful. They destroyed themselves, and Yoko did play a part in that, but it's kind of like the same picture as with John's marriage. It's not like she came in and ruined a perfectly good thing. And by insinuating that, you're almost saying that the Beatles were, as you said, a bunch of children that just needed like one grown woman to say, you split up, and that was it.
And you're writing off Cynthia and John's very real struggles throughout their whole relationship.
Yeah.
That John was not a good partner to her.
No. We'll come back to this.
I got it. Bigger picture. I got it. I forgot to include this line in the script, even though it is the best possible distillation I can could possibly come up with for this situation. Yoko was not the destruction. She was the distraction. She was John's excuse yes. to check out.
That is perfect.
He was looking yes. for a way. He says so himself in his Rolling Stone interview and in his Playboy interview. He was looking for a way out, and Yoko showed up, and he used her as a distraction.
And yes, Yoko also ruined her marriage. She also cheated on her husband, and we don't want to, like, take that away because that, too, is shitty.
No, we'll get into how that affected, the very real ways that affected her daughter, yes, Kyoko.
And it was shitty of everyone to cheat.
Poor decisions. Poor decisions all around.
Wild that all the blame is always put on Yoko when, with an affair, there are at least two people responsible.
Soon, John asked Yoko to accompany him to recording sessions for what became the White Album. The popular narrative is that having wives around at the studio was against Beatle protocol. In reality, they'd been dropping by for a long time. Patty Boyd was the first Beatle wife to sing on a Beatles album. You can hear her in the chorus of Yellow Submarine off Revolver. Patty, Maureen Starkey, and Yoko can all be heard on Birthday, and Yoko got a line to sing on Bungalow Bill. And asked him if to kill was not a sin.
Not when he looked so fierce.
His mommy petted him.
If looks could kill, it would have been us instead of him.
All the children sing.
She got most involved on what became Revolution 9, repeating, "You become naked amidst the noise." Still, having a Beatles significant other so involved in the creative process, especially giving artistic opinions when they were not asked of her, was very new and not particularly welcome. When Jan Wenner asked what the Beatles' reactions were when he first brought Yoko to the studio, John said, "They despised her. They insulted her, and they still do." But John didn't care. He'd always wanted a strong personality and an artistic woman, someone he considered his intellectual equal. Though she was beautiful and smart and a wonderful mother, he never respected Cynthia that way. Paul said, quote, "My estimation of it was that Cynthia wanted to tie John down to the pipe and slippers nice life." Of course, John was never ready for that. He sought a challenge, and he deeply revered Yoko. They shared a deep connection over their tumultuous childhoods in war-torn countries, in which they both felt rejected by their respective parents. David Sheff says John, quote, "appreciated her purity, naivete, and sophistication, a combination of confidence and shyness. She was exuberant, excited about ideas. She truly believed, as he did, in love and peace."
We spoke about this in the Cynthia episode, that she even said something along the lines of she would have wished that they would have just lived this normal life, that he would have just gotten a regular job that would have worked for her. In the beginning, when they started dating, that worked, but because they were such different people living such different lives, at this point, Yoko fit way better with him, because she also stood up to him.
Cynthia expressed in her own memoir yes. that she struggled standing up to John. Like, he would just verbally steamroll
yeah, and
her.
I think that Yoko was the better match at this point. However, he should have still broken up with his wife first, go through the divorce, and then started dating her. That would have been the respectful thing to do.
In a perfect world, that's what happened. Yeah, it's... John didn't deserve Cynthia.
No.
Yoko and John deserved each other.
I feel like it's almost symbolic that their relationship started with mutual cheating. Mm-hmm. Because it just shows the moral ground and, like, the way that these two treat people. Mm-hmm. Not everyone, not always, but the way that they are capable of treating people, that definitely puts them in the same tier of people.
Anything you say, dear.
Watching Get Back, it's clear Yoko's presence wasn't nearly as much a nuisance as it was made out to be in the earlier Let It Be film. Yoko sits quietly, practices calligraphy, reads a book, and writes, though always glued to John's side. There's a sweet moment when the two dance together while the guys play I Me Mine. The Beatles' resentment grew towards the ever-present Yoko, though, especially when John had a bed brought into the studio during Abbey Road sessions in 1969. They thought it was weird that she went literally everywhere with him, even the bathroom. The public's resentment grew as well. When Yoko attended the premiere of a play based on John's book in his own right, hecklers yelled at John, "Where's your wife?" But had it not been for Yoko going to all these places with him, he might not have gone at all. Watching Get Back, it's clear John was emotionally checked out from the Beatles. He constantly showed up late to both White Album and Get Back sessions, if he'd show up at all. When he did show, he was high on heroin. Chef's book glazes right over this, but John and Yoko experienced very intense, very public addiction together. And they absolutely fueled each other's addictions. John looks unwashed in Get Back, showing up in the same black sweater, pants, sneakers, and fur coat day after day. One famous interview of the era for CBC TV, dubbed Two Junkies, shows them both very high. On October 18th, 1968, John and Yoko were busted for possession of marijuana at their apartment. They were so interested in this supposed weed, they completely missed the heroin. John pled guilty to possession, though, to spare Yoko the stress of a trial. She had just announced her pregnancy. As John was gearing up for the release of the White Album, Yoko got sick. John rushed to the hospital to be by her side. They recorded the baby's heartbeat. The next morning, Yoko miscarried. John blamed the stress of the drug bust. Their first child's heartbeat was immortalized as the track Baby's Heartbeat on unfinished number 2, Life with the Lions.
Yoko threw herself into making art to cope with the loss of her child. She made one of her most controversial films, number 6, Rape, in which the cameraman was instructed to pursue a woman on the street, through the subway, and to her apartment. He says nothing, chasing her all the way home. The subject of the film had no idea what was happening. When number 6 was made, it was perceived as a feminist statement, capturing the very real violation of a woman's privacy and safety at home in real time. Nowadays, we understand Yoko effectively directing a cameraman to stalk a random girl on the street to be grossly unethical. All parties have to consent to projects such as this. When Yoko's 1969 film Self-Portrait, a slow motion film of John's penis, was shown at the Institute of Contemporary Arts in London, the public outcry against their relationship only heightened. Now Yoko hadn't just ruined John's marriage, she was robbing him of his dignity.
We also need to unpack how insane it is that Yoko directed a cameraman to stalk a woman, a random woman in the street all the way home.
Yeah.
What the hell is that?
I do have to say, I think the idea of the film isn't bad. It has a message.
If you had an actress.
That is the point. You should have just instructed a woman and be like, hey, let's do this. And this would have been a really interesting and very forward-putting film. But it's just insanely creepy.
It's such a violation.
The constant controversy and trauma of losing a child bonded John and Yoko. In March of 1969, once both their respective divorces were finalized, they decided to marry. Seeing as she was 36 years old and this would be her third marriage, Yoko didn't need legal papers to prove her love. John, however, was set on it. Once John Lennon made his mind up, it was difficult to change it. He was younger, and when he was in love, he was head over heels. He wanted to shout from the rooftops, "I am in love with Yoko Ono!" He kind of did it when he sang Don't Let Me Down at the rooftop concert a couple months before, a song about Yoko. Don't let me down.
I'm in love for the first time. Don't you know it's gonna last? It's a love that lasts forever. It's a love that has no past. Don't let me down.
But once she saw what marriage meant to John and that Paul and Linda McCartney were recently wed, Yoko acquiesced. John and Yoko planned to get married on a ferry crossing the English Channel, but they were turned away as Yoko didn't have a passport. They flew to Paris to regroup. Apple Corps employee and John's assistant, Peter Brown, called to say, "You can make it okay, you can get married in Gibraltar near Spain." You've probably heard this story before in the Beatles song, The Ballad of John and Yoko. Christ, you know, it wasn't easy to make that flight, but they did, and on March 20th, 1969, John Lennon and Yoko Ono were married. John wore a white corduroy suit, turtleneck sweater, and his trademark sneakers, while Yoko wore a white top and miniskirt, knee socks, and a big white floppy hat with her dark sunglasses. They looked terribly cool. I just have to say, this is one of the coolest ways to get married. Like, especially back then, the idea of just having this very, very low maintenance, very casual wedding is so cool.
And when you think of iconic wedding looks, I think of Bianca Jagger's pantsuit, Linda McCartney's little yellow getup, and Yoko and her floppy hat and sunglasses. Honestly, can we open up, because we both love talking about clothes, can we open up that Yoko's style, especially in Get Back, was really good.
Yes.
Her clothes, all black, tailored very nicely. The wrap tops, the long skirts.
She understood what works for her. And she, in the simplicity of her outfits, they were all so perfect. Their honeymoon would be anything but conventional. To play off the love-ins, human beings, and sit-ins all over America in response to the country's involvement in Vietnam, Yoko came up with the bed-in. On March 25th, John and Yoko put on their jammies and spent their honeymoon in bed. They made signs that said hairpiece and bedpiece and took hundreds of calls and visitors spreading the word of world peace. Was it perfect? Not by any means. They shacked up in a fancy hotel and had the housekeeping staff come in and clean. But John and Yoko presented a united front. Together, they would make art, have a family, and fight for world peace. Come hell or high water, nothing could break them apart. They were set on happily ever after.
Thanks for tuning in to part one of this two-part season finale of Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s.
As always, we're Emma
and Abby,
your hosts, and we're thrilled to have you with us on this groovy adventure. Remember, the spirit of these trailblazing ladies lives on in each one of us, inspiring us to embrace our individuality, creativity, and passion for change.
If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe to, rate, and review the show on your favorite streaming platform.
Your feedback means the world to us, and it helps others discover the magic of these legendary dolls. And we hope you'll return next week for the conclusion of our two-part episode about Yoko Ono.
As always, we'd like to thank special friend of the show, Michael Teggio, for the wonderful intro song. Until the next time, keep the music loud, the fashion groovy, and the spirit of the 60s and 70s alive in your hearts.
Peace,
love,
and rock and roll.